The soldiers walked through the dark with machetes, and the word was parsley, not the smell of blood, not orders written on paper, not a map, one word, spoken in Spanish, perejil. They would hold up a sprig of the herb, green and ordinary, the kind of thing you pulled from any kitchen garden, and they would ask you to say what it was, and the way your mouth shaped that one word would decide whether you lived or died that night. This is October 1937, the Dominican Republic, and what happened over the next 6 days would become one of the most documented, most deliberate, and least known acts of state-sponsored ethnic cleansing in the Western Hemisphere. Rafael Trujillo had been in power for 7 years. He called himself El Jefe, the chief, and he was the kind of man who had a statue of himself built during his own lifetime and made sure the lights were always on it. He controlled the press, the military, the courts, the church, the sugar industry, and nearly every dollar that moved through the Dominican economy. He was 32 years old when he seized power in a coup in 1930. By 1937, he had cultivated relationships with the United States government, invited international investment, and built a public image abroad, at least, as a modernizing strongman. The kind of dictator the mid-century American foreign policy apparatus could do business with. But Trujillo had a fixation. He called it blanqueamiento, whitening. The Dominican Republic, in his vision, was to become culturally and racially distinct from Haiti. The border between the two nations, which occupied the same island of Hispaniola, had always been fluid. Haitians had moved east for generations, working the sugar harvest, farming subsistence plots, building communities in the borderlands where the two cultures had blended for a century. Trujillo looked at this, at people who looked Haitian, spoke Haitian Creole, practiced Vaudou, bore Haitian names, and called it an invasion. In the months before October 1937, he toured the northern border region. What he saw, or claimed to see, disturbed him. He would later say that he had personally witnessed Haitians stealing cattle from Dominican ranchers, stripping the border towns bare. Historians have found little evidence that this was true at the scale he described. What is documented is what he said to the crowd at a party in Dajabon, the border town closest to Haiti, on the night of October 2nd. 300 Haitians are now dead. It was not an accident. It was not a riot. It was an announcement. The soldiers already had their orders. They moved at night, mostly, though not always. They moved through every town, every hamlet, every collection of houses within reach of the border. The test was simple. Produce a sprig of parsley and ask the person before you to name it. Perejil. The word required a hard Spanish rolled R, a sound that Haitian Creole, rooted in French, simply did not produce. Speakers of Haitian Creole who tried to say perejil would produce something closer to pelejil, the R coming out soft, the tongue not rolling. That difference, that single phonetic feature that separated two languages, became a death sentence. They called it el corte, the cut. The killing lasted approximately 6 days, though sporadic violence continued beyond that. The dead were overwhelmingly Haitian, or of Haitian descent, including, in some documented cases, Dominicans of darker complexion, who could not convince the soldiers fast enough that they were Dominican. The river that ran along part of the border, the Massacre River, which had been named for a 17th century Spanish and English conflict, ran red again. Bodies were thrown into it. Bodies were left in fields. Bodies were found floating in the ocean, having been thrown from cliffs along the northern coast. The historian Lauren Derby, who spent years researching this event, documented survivor testimonies that described machetes being used specifically to avoid ammunition expenditure. Trujillo reportedly wanted the massacre to look like civilian unrest rather than a military operation. Some testimonies described soldiers burning houses with families inside. Others described the machetes working through the night until the soldiers' arms tired. Estimating the dead has been the work of scholars, not governments. The Haitian government's official complaint in the days following cited 5,000 dead. Subsequent historical research by Richard Turritz and others placed the number between 15,000 and 20,000. Some estimates go higher. The official Dominican government figure, for years, was under 1,000. Trujillo's own administration denied that anything systematic had occurred. Here is where the mystery deepens, and it is a mystery that begins not in the Dominican Republic, but in Port-au-Prince. Within months of the massacre, Haiti's government agreed to a settlement. The figure agreed upon was $525,000 paid by the Dominican Republic to Haiti, as what Trujillo called an indemnité. An indemnity, a word that in diplomatic French carries the connotation of a practical settlement between parties, not an admission of guilt. The Haitian government accepted it. More than that, Haiti's president at the time, Stenio Vincent, actively limited public discussion of what had happened. Haitian survivors who had crossed back into Haiti were not given a formal platform. The press was not encouraged to report extensively. The settlement closed the diplomatic file. Why? Historians have offered several explanations. Vincent was himself a man of the educated Haitian elite, a demographic that had complex and often tense relationships with the darker-skinned, Creole-speaking border communities, who made up the massacre's victims. There is documented evidence of class-based indifference. There is also the question of political survival. Vincent needed regional stability, needed trade relationships, needed not to push Trujillo into actions that might destabilize Haiti further. And there is the question of outside pressure. The United States had, at various points, occupied both Haiti and the Dominican Republic. American financial interests were deeply embedded in both nations. The Roosevelt administration's good neighbor policy committed the U.S. to non-intervention in Latin American affairs, which meant, in practice, that the State Department would not take an aggressive posture toward Trujillo over what had happened along a border that most American officials had never seen and could not easily locate on a map. Declassified cables show that American diplomats were aware of the event within days. They described it in carefully measured language. No sanctions followed. No international tribunal was convened. Trujillo remained in power for another 24 years. The word perejil would eventually become a symbol, specifically because the American poet Julia Alvarez used it in her work, and because the Rita Dove poem Parsley depicted the moment of Trujillo giving the order from inside the paranoid logic of a dictator's mind. Perejil became the shorthand in the Caribbean diaspora for linguistically defined murder, the idea that the way your tongue moved in your own mouth could mark you for death. What made this method so calculated and so historically significant was that it could not have worked in reverse. Dominican soldiers were not being asked to say a Haitian word. The test only moved in one direction. It was designed to identify Haitianness through embodied linguistic difference, through something that cannot be faked under duress, the way a language lives in the mouth. You cannot roll an R. You were never taught to roll when a machete is 2 feet from your face. The survivors who made it back across the river carried the memory with them across generations. For decades, the massacre was discussed within the Haitian diaspora, in Brooklyn, in Miami, in Montreal, while remaining largely absent from mainstream American historical education. When the Dominican Republic's government finally acknowledged the massacre more formally in the early 21st century, the acknowledgement came without reparations to survivors' descendants and without the establishment of a formal memorial on the Dominican side. The Massacre River still exists. It runs between Dajabon on the Dominican side and Uanamintha on the Haitian side. Every Monday and Friday, there is a border market where Dominican and Haitian traders buy and sell across a bridge above the water. Commerce continues. The river has, more or less, forgotten what it holds. The Parsley test survives in memory because it collapsed, something we tend to think of as fluid, language, accent, the voice, into something fixed and fatal. Trujillo understood that a massacre needs a mechanism. A mechanism gives it plausible distance from the person who ordered it. He was not there on any of the 6 nights. He was in the capital. He had said what he needed to say at the party in Dajabon. The soldiers knew what to do. In the Caribbean, there is a long tradition of what historians call the archive silence, the deliberate absence of records where records should exist. The diplomatic cable that closed the Haiti-Dominican file in 1938 was not a silence that happened by accident. Someone negotiated that silence. Someone accepted money in exchange for it. The $525,000 worked out to roughly $26 per confirmed victim, using the lower-end historical estimate. No court has ever assigned legal responsibility. No family has received formal redress. Trujillo was assassinated in 1961, shot by Dominican dissidents in a CIA-supported operation on a highway outside Santo Domingo. He was 70 years old. He died in his country, in his car, wearing his uniform. No formal process ever named him responsible for October 1937. The word in the historical record where it appears is massacre. The word in the diplomatic record for nearly two decades after was effectively nothing. What does it mean for a word to carry this weight? The linguist and cultural theorist Edouard Glissant wrote that the Caribbean's history is one of the abyss, the ocean as the site of disappearance, the gap between the African past and the Caribbean present, the silence where a record should be. El Corta added another kind of gap, the gap between a language and a life. The moment the tongue fails to produce a sound it was never trained to make, and that failure is the final thing anyone notices about you. The parsley is still green. The word is still parsley. The river still runs between the two nations. And the question that survives every diplomatic settlement, every indemnity payment, every careful silence in every capital where the decision was made to look the other way, is this. At what point does a nation's decision to accept money for mass murder become indistinguishable from endorsing it? And who exactly bears the weight of that choice, 70 years on?